Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. Our guests are Richie Castellano and his father, John Castellano. Richie is a member of the classic rock group Blue Oyster Cult, where he plays guitar and sings alongside founding members Buck Dharma and Eric Bloom. Richie is also the creator of the Band Geeks on YouTube, a supremely talented group of his musician friends who do brilliantly executed covers of classic songs like the recently released Roundabout by Yes, among many others, recorded in Richie's state-of-the-art basement studio. On Sundays, Castellano plays for 2 to 3 hours live on YouTube doing both original songs and covers from bands like Queen, The Beatles, Cream, and Chicago, just to name a few. His dad, John, is also a very accomplished singer and guitar player, and as you'll hear, is part of a long line of New York City-based musicians in a very musical family. Richie and John Castellano joined us from their homes in New York. Richie and John, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks for having us.
And I'd like to start out, Richie, you know, in this time of pandemic, it is so difficult for musicians and artists of all kinds, any kind of performers. Could you tell us about how challenging this has been briefly for you, you know, this last year trying to deal with, you know, being a musician and not being able to, you know, go out in the world and perform?
It's a real bummer, actually, because this is what we do. We play in front of people. We feed off the energy of an audience. And there's a whole, obviously, as you know, a whole industry built around this, not only the performers, but the crew people, the people who work at local venues. A lot of people are out of work right now. And it's horrible, to be honest. There's no other way to look at it. It's just horrible. But thanks to technology, there are ways that we can keep the show going to a certain extent. And those are the challenges that a lot of musicians, you know, when everything locked down, that we were all facing and we had to look at and come up with creative solutions to solve this problem, or at least deal with it.
Yeah, and we'll get into some of your creative solutions a little later. But first, I'd like to explore your origins a bit. You, from what I've seen and heard, you have a very, you know, musical family. Could you tell us a bit about your upbringing? And John, could you quickly tell us, when did you, you know, realize that you had a kid who was, you know, really musically inclined?
Well, Richie was born at a very young age. I'll tell you when. Absolutely when. There was a moment. So I don't know, maybe it was 5. And something like that. And we had to go to a friend of mine's shop, who was like a repairman for the guitars. So we went into the room, and there was about 18, 20 guitars on stands. And while I'm having dialogue, talking to the guy, you know, we're talking about, you know, all this stuff, you know, musician stuff. And Richie was walking around the room, and I was watching, be careful, I don't knock anything over. And he was going over to the guitars, and he was running his fingers very, very carefully over the guitar necks. And he was going, bring. I go, this is in tune. He goes, that's in tune. This is out of tune. And he's doing this as he's walking past the instruments. And the guy looks at me, because he's a musician too. And he goes, you got to get this kid lessons. And that's where we took it from.
Wow.
And then one night I was on a music job, and we just got one of those, you know, those shoulder video cams. It was like, you know, weighed about 10 pounds. And I had just shown him how to play like an A, a D, and an E, or something like that, to record a 1-4-5 in one key or another, with easy chords, you know. And so from that, I come home from my music job. And in that interim of my 6 or 8 hours away playing, he shows me a tape of him playing, you know, You're Mine and We Belong Together, or something like that. And a 3-chord song, and he did it. I couldn't believe it. I said, he put a video out of him singing, and I mean, he was struggling with his twisting his face and contorting his face to sing the song. I said, this is amazing. And it went from there. It was like a runaway train.
Wow. And Richie, can you tell us about your dad and your family, because your dad's a musician. So could you tell our listeners about the influence he's had on you, and tell us a little bit about him?
I'm a fifth generation musician. Obviously, my dad's a musician. His dad was a musician, and his dad was a musician.
And his dad was a musician.
Yeah, so there's a lot of. Just to go back to the very beginning, I think my great-great-grandfather was a guitar player. Is that correct?
That's what the best we can ascertain. We did research into it, and one of my cousins came up and said, yeah, great-grandpa was a guitar player, played guitar. But my grandfather, he was prolific. I mean, he had his regular day job, but he could play piano, bass, he could play French horn, and of course violin, and he played some guitar.
And that was that Frank?
Frank Castellano, yeah, his grandpa. And then my father, he played in weddings, and he was a lefty bass player. And
I have his bass upstairs, which is really awesome.
An old K bass.
Yeah.
I think he played behind Marilyn Monroe once, and he was playing a beauty pageant, and one of the girls tripped and fell into his bass and broke the headstock. So it's got a real, you know,
jury rig
yeah. gluing job. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a big nail in the headstock with yeah. glue. Like just it's.
Hey, they couldn't afford going to repair me.
That's what it is. But my dad's a guitar player and a singer. I would say that you are blues, R&B, soul, that kind of stuff.
You'd be right.
And he did a tour with the Chambers Brothers, which oddly enough, he early on crossed paths with my current employers, Blue Oyster Cult.
Yeah.
And
it was on an Alice Cooper tour.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it was 3 dates we did with them. And so the opening act was B.O.C. And we followed the Chambers Brothers. And then Alice closed the show.
Wow. So, yeah, my dad was a huge influence just because, you know, growing up, there was always music in the house. It wasn't like he was listening to records. A lot of people say, oh, there was music in the house, meaning, you know, they were listening to albums. Like, no, he was playing all the time and working and rehearsing with his band. And I remember the band always used to rehearse in our basement. So he would allow me, as long as I wasn't being annoying, which is rare, but he allowed me to watch the band rehearsals and just see how professional musicians conducted themselves. And I got to watch him as he ran rehearsals and sort of soak it all in and realize, oh, this is what a band leader does. This is there has to be someone in charge of the rehearsal or else nothing gets done. And there has to be someone who keeps things moving along and who tells everybody, okay, you sing this part. No, you're playing that too fast. No, you're cutting. And my father was doing that. And I really got a lot from that, from watching that.
And so how old would you have been when that was going on?
I was like, you know, 7, 8. And another thing I don't want to gloss over is as big as an influence as my father is, I have an equal influence from my uncle, who was the bass player in my father's band. And whereas my father had the whole band leader side of the thing, my uncle had the whole tech side down. And my uncle was the one that introduced me to things like MIDI and sequencing. And he taught me all that. He taught me about multi-track recording. I was very fortunate because when my uncle had small kids in the house, he had a you know, reel-to-reel multi-track tape recorder, and you know, he was afraid of the kids messing it up, so he set up a whole recording studio in my basement when I was a teenager, when I was like 14 years old.
Well, explain that my brother, who's the bass player and technical side of it, he lives right behind me, so you walk across the backyard and you're in my back door or vice versa, my brother's back door, so we have a huge yard we share,
you know. My uncle, you know, musically speaking, my father, I got all my blues influence, a lot of, you know, Black American music. And then from my uncle, I got the whole English rock thing. You know, he got me into Yes
Genesis
and Queen and all those bands.
That's where that comes from.
Yeah. And my dad was where I was hearing Stevie Wonder. I was hearing Eric Clapton.
Yeah.
You know,
so when we ride in the car, if it was my car, we listened to what R&B and stuff. And if I was riding in my brother's car, it was, you know, his Floyd. And I said, you know, great. Next.
So I actually, you know, I like both of them. You know, I think it was just funny because my dad and my uncle, it would just like that, it would be battling for control of the radio.
Yes.
But me, I was like, oh, I love this Stevie Wonder song. Or, oh, I love this Yes song. You know, it was like I got to experience the best of both.
And then when you got to be a teenager, you started to want to play some of this stuff that you really like. What were like some of the first, you know, songs that you started to play where you realized it's like, hey, I can really play this stuff, like some of the more complicated stuff, like Yes or whatever.
Like the prog stuff?
Yeah.
So here's the story. Like a lot of the times I experience growth spurts musically when I get upset about something. And my uncle criticized my taste in music. I was really into the Beatles when I was about, 15 years old, maybe 14, 15. And I knew everything there was to know about the Beatles. I was a real Beatles nerd. And he said to me, you only like music that is in 4/4 time. You don't like music that people can dance to. You don't like anything complicated. Everything is poppy and easy. And I got really upset about that. So like a week later, I played a gig with my band in junior high school, and my dad came, and I'm sorry to out you on this, Dad. He said, that was the worst gig I've ever seen. he goes, that's probably the worst gig you will ever do in your life. And I was like, really? He goes, yeah, it was horrendous. He says, you're going to be making up for that gig with other gigs. So
was that the one you played out in the park area?
No, we played it. Oh, there's another bad gig?
The one you tried the first prog rock thing?
No.
With Andy and Andy?
No. We did. It was a gig I played at PS60 in the lunchroom.
Oh, God.
And you were brutal. And I came home. I was really upset about it. And I put on, my uncle gave me a Yes CD to try to, broaden my horizons into music that was a little more virtuosic, not so easily accessible, and I just put on Heart of the Sunrise. And as a punishment to myself, I sat there and learned the whole thing on guitar. And I didn't like it when I started learning it. By the time I got to the end of the song, I was hooked on Yes, because I realized, like, oh, wait a minute, there's something to this. These guys are on another level. I mean, maybe they're not on the songwriting level as the Beatles, but they play better than the Beatles. that is for sure. And it's much more challenging to be able to replicate this.
Yeah, it's difficult to play. And as we'll find out later, you've done that quite well. You don't have a guitar or a bass that you could grab real quick, do you?
Yeah, well, which one do you want, guitar or bass?
Either one. Can you play some riff off of Heart of the Sunrise real quick for us? We need keyboards.
There you go.
If you're just joining us, our guests are Richie Castellano and his father, John. Both are outstanding musicians based in New York, and Richie is a member of the resurgent classic rock band Blue Oyster Cult. Let's take a short break, but stay with us. I'm Dave Schloem, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to my conversation with Richie Castellano and his father, John. They joined us from their homes in New York.
My very first guitar, I think, was like a novelty miniature Les Paul that my grandmother gave me. And it's a guitar I actually played in the Whitney Houston Greatest Love of All video. when I was a kid, my mom's friend worked for Arista Records and got me a spot on as one of the children performers.
For the Greatest Love of All video.
Yeah, yeah.
At the Apollo Theater.
That's right.
So Sissy Houston, which is Whitney Houston's mom, she was the scene was the Apollo Theater and the children are coming out and they're playing. So they needed kid musicians. So there's a little girl with violin and other, you know, all that stuff and different trumpet and whatever. And they were just props. So Richie brought his little Les Paul and he's standing there, but like the little string that's in the key, it's had a little sharp edge to it. And so they stood Richie right next to Sissy Houston, and that string thing kept on catching on to Sissy Houston's dress, and they moved him to the back and ran out of the shot. But so I felt bad. He was there for 8 hours.
Yeah. So I had that, but that really wasn't playable. It was more of a, you know, guitar that looked cool, but never stayed in tune or anything like that. So
you had to tune it to G.
Right. It's just to get the tension right.
Right.
But I had like a couple of half size acoustics, and then I think a 3/4 size acoustic, just because I was small. I was 8 years old when I started playing guitar, and once I, you know, was starting to really get around on the acoustic, I told my dad I think I'd like an electric guitar now. And one of the cool things about growing up in this family is at the time my grandfather and my grandmother had a music store called Bath Music in Brooklyn that they ran together, the truest definition of a mom and pop store. And, you know, we went to Brooklyn, my dad took me there, and I picked a guitar. I saw a Black Squire Telecaster, and that was my guitar. I played it for a few months, and it was the heaviest thing ever, especially for, you know, someone who was 9 or 10 at the moment.
That's when you started to play with my band. I used to feature you for a couple of songs.
Yeah, but like the telly was, I couldn't make it work. It was just too heavy. So I went back to my grandfather's store, and I traded him the Telecaster, which was too heavy, for a Fender Squire Bullet, Japanese-made, which is a phenomenal guitar that I still have today. It still plays good. It's like a sort of a shrunken Strat, and it was great, and I was able to really dig into that guitar, and I loved it. I got an Applause, which is like an ovation, like the import ovation. And it was like an acoustic guitar that looked like a salad bowl. But I brought that to school with me every day. That was, you know, I played that guitar more than anything.
Richie played guitar in the marching band, electric guitar.
Really?
In the marching band, yes.
Yeah.
He got those little practice amps about the size of half of a lunchbox. And he put like two on his belt, attaching like a Batman's utility belt.
What I did, I mean, this didn't, you couldn't hear me, it didn't make a difference. But what I did was I took one of those practice amps, battery powered, and my father had these old hotspot wedges that he wasn't using anymore. So what I did was I like connected two of them. They had two little, I think it was 5-inch speakers each.
Yeah.
And I connected them, so I had 4 5-inch speakers, and then I remember soldering all the cables together so that it would the sound would go through all the speakers, not understanding the science behind it, that it wasn't making it louder. It was just making the battery die faster.
But it's a Woody Allen moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's fast forward to the present a bit. And, you know, I saw you make a comment the other day that you don't collect guitars. And then I saw how many guitars you had. And I went, well, I don't know what your definition of collecting is or not, but I'm sure there are people that have more. But like approximately how many guitars do you have now?
Maybe 30.
30. Yeah. And you know what it reminds me of is, and I'd like you to explain this to us, because most of us are not musicians and don't have electric guitars and don't understand the different kinds there are and why you'd want to use one. But it reminds me of surfing. Like if I go to Jamie O'Brien's garage in the North Shore of Oahu, you know, his garage is full of boards, and it just depends on the conditions of the day and what kind of wave he's going to surf and what he wants to do, that he picks out a board for that day. And it kind of seems like to me that there's an analogy there with guitars. Can you tell us a bit about, you know, the different kinds of guitars that you use for different types of songs and gigs?
Yeah.
And why that's important?
And that's exactly why I don't consider what I'm doing to be collecting, because collecting sort of has this connotation to it that it's you're doing it out of some sort of fixation and not out of a need. Mm-hmm. They're tools. I mean, look, I have a few things that are sentimental to me. Like I have a Rickenbacker 3/4 guitar that my dad got me for Christmas one year, and that I've incredible sentimental attachment to. It's a useless guitar. It doesn't sound good doing anything.
Sort of like me.
But I keep it. Because it's a Beatles guitar. It was my first.
Oh, is that the one
that
looks like John Lennon's guitar?
Yeah, it's a John Lennon Rickenbacker 3/4 guitar. And because I'm such a Beatles nut, and because my dad got it for me, you know, that's a guitar I won't sell because I just love that guitar. I would never bring it on a gig, but I cherish that one. But the rest of them I got out of a sonic requirement, just a requirement for my hands. I just found that when I was 16 years old, I was borrowing guitars from my dad because, you know, you go through puberty, you get taller, your hands grow. And I had these starter guitars I got from my grandfather. And my dad took me guitar shopping and he said, it's time to find what you like in a guitar. And what I ended up liking was the Ernie Ball Music Man Eddie Van Halen. It had the perfect neck for me. I liked everything about that guitar. I loved the sound of it. I liked that it had a Floyd Rose, you know, whammy bar system. And it was just funny because, you know, I grew up with my dad being my only guitar influence. So I was thinking like, oh, I'd play what my dad played. And I didn't even really know anything about Van Halen when I got that Eddie Van Halen guitar. I was not a Van Halen fan. I was a Beatles fan. But I just picked up that guitar and I just looked at it as a piece of engineering saying, this person figured out all the problems there are with this instrument and he solved them. And that's how I feel about Eddie Van Halen. You know, when I'm talking to people about, oh, you know, you need this kind of nut and you have to do this. And I'm like, Eddie Van Halen figured all this out for us in the 80s. You know, anybody who wants to play rock the way I want to play it, you know, where it's aggressive and I'm dive bombing and I'm really beating the crap out of the guitar, Eddie figured out the way to do this and to have a reliable instrument. And I, you know, basically would just seek out guitars that had similar qualities to that, but different sonically. Like, for example, that to play a double humbucker guitar, it's not the ideal sound for every kind of gig. I mean, it's a good sound and it's versatile and you can do a lot of things with it. But sometimes you get calls for, oh, you know, I want a kind of like a Stevie Ray Vaughan thing. And if that's the case, then you have to get a Stratocaster. Like you have to, because that's the only way you're getting that sound.
It's like a toolbox. Like when you want to buy tools, you don't buy one screwdriver. You buy all different sizes. It's the same thing. It's the same application for guitars, because one screwdriver might be comfortable to do it and another screwdriver may not be comfortable, and you'll see that you need different things. And that's the same application for guitars.
Yeah.
It's not only the sonic properties of them, they make you play different. Like, for example, my main guitar, you know, the Federa or the Axis, they both have two, you know, humbucking pickups, right? A Les Paul has two humbucking pickups. When I play a Les Paul, as opposed to the Axis or the Van Halen or anything else, I sound like a different guitar player because the shape of the guitar, the scale, the fretboard radius, all these things make you play different. They force you to play differently. There's licks I can't do on a Les Paul that I can do on my other guitars just because of the fact that there's a there's only one cutaway and it's got this really big heel and you can't get high, you know, so it's the different types of guitars facilitate not only tonal differences, but performance differences.
Oh, yeah, no, that makes sense. Do you have like a couple where you could demonstrate for us, you know, the sonic differences or even tell us about, you know, how differently it is for you to play them so the listener could hear that?
Yeah, give me a second.
Play us a couple of riffs, yeah.
Telecasters are like Albert Collins and a lot of country players love Telecasters. And Richie's trying a blonde Telecaster right now with a maple neck. Once again, everything factors in. The weight, the size, the width of the neck, mm-hmm. You know. So this Telecaster is probably the first shape of electric guitars.
Right, that's why I grabbed it. This is the first, kind of the first, you know, design of electric guitars. And it's got this, got two pickups on it, and they're single coil. I'm kind of cheating right now because these are noise-canceling single coils, but if they were the original design, they would be humming right now.
Right, but making a lot of hissing sound. Oh, yeah.
You kind of hear it twang a little bit. It snarls. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's got that snarly, twangy sound, yeah.
Right. And then the Fender followed that up with the Stratocaster, which is what I'm going to grab next.
Well, originally they came out in about 48. They were called the Nocaster. And then they became, I think it was a Broadcaster, they called it. But they were copyright infringing upon, I think it was Gretsch. And they made him change the name, so they called it a Telecaster. Tele meaning television, because that was when television was new.
Oh.
Then in around 1954, they came out with the Stratocaster, which was a three single pickup guitar with only a three-way switch. You switched it one switch, it was one pickup, then the second switch, the middle pickup, and then the bridge pickup. So, you're going to play it now. Hendrix, Clapton, Jimmy Ray Vaughan.
Yeah.
David Gilmour.
Yeah.
So it's more of a glassy kind of sound, they say.
Yeah.
It just has more tonal variation than the Tele. And also players started doing these kind of like weird split pickup things where they would get...
Oh, it was by accident they found it.
They would put the pickup selector, there was only three positions, but they would kind of put it in the middle and get this really cool sound. You know, Hendrix all day.
Yeah. Well, that's
great. But that led to the humbucking pickup, because the Stratocaster 2 in the beginning was, had a little hiss. Now, the Les Pauls, what they actually did, because they found that switch in the middle, the actual hiss was less when they was combining two pickups. So they put two pickups together. I think it was Bill Lawrence and some other guys along the way. Historically, it could be all incorrect. But I'm saying that they, when they found the two pickups put together, was a louder and mellower sound. Like, here it is playing a Les Paul now.
And that's Les Paul?
Yep. That's a Les Paul.
Yeah. Wow.
Sustain.
Yeah, unbelievable sustain.
You can go and have a bite.
Goes to 11.
And this thing will still be sustaining.
And but the thing with Les Paul, and when you see how they keep on improving on the Mousetrap, Les Paul works with four dials. And so you have a three-way switch on top of the guitar and four dials on the bottom. So you have a volume for each pickup and a tone setting for each pickup, which the other companies started to come out with, hey, we don't need that. We just need a three-way switch and two dials, the volume for both pickups and the tone for both pickups. And that's what he's playing now. I think it's a Music Man. This one's a Steve Morse.
This is what they would call a super strat. So what guys started doing is they wanted the humbucker from the Les Paul, but they wanted to still have the single coils from the Strat. You know, this is when, like, in the 70s, when guys had to do a lot of sessions, and they wanted to bring one guitar with them that can do both. So,
like, if you're going to do sessions, like, say you and I are both guitar players, and we're going to do a session. We don't know what session we're doing, but we're doing a session. A battery of guitars that you should have basically would be a Telecaster, a Les Paul, a Stratocaster, maybe a 12-string Rickenbacker, and, you need to have an acoustic guitar, a nylon guitar. These are the guitars that most guitar players would have in there as their battery of instruments.
So here's a Luke 3, which is a Music Man guitar, but this is what would be called a Super Strat, because you can get the Stratocaster. But you also have a humbucker in here. mean, I can always trick it out a little bit to get more sounds than just the three, you know, double humbucker sounds that
you can split the humbuckers, you know, you can get to single coil, but it's like, I don't like a lot of things with, it's like a garden hose. I use that analogy. If you have a garden hose and you want to see the velocity of the water coming out, you turn it on full. And say you poke a little pinholes, nail holes in the hose, the velocity would decrease because it's losing water through the holes. Well, I feel that every extra solder joint or little dial you put in or switch, that sort of dissipates the power of the instrument. And I like it very pure.
Now, that's a very good segue to the next guitar I just picked up. This, now I have what they call like a Frankenstrat. And this is something that was developed by Eddie Van Halen because, you know, he basically, you know, what my dad just said about, you know, almost like diluting the tone. He had a one pickup guitar
and one dial.
Yeah, a lot of times with one knob. And he would put on a Floyd Rose tremolo system, which is what I have on this guitar. Right now I'm holding a 80s Kramer Pacer, which is actually something I got from my grandparents' store.
You hear that beast?
Yeah.
That's wow. Completely undiluted. That's full velocity of what the pickup will put out with not a lot of frills.
That's the hose all the way on.
The way on, full velocity. Yeah.
Let's take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our visit with rock guitarist, singer, and songwriter Richie Castellano and his father, John, who's an accomplished guitarist and singer in his own right. Stay with us. And we're back. Let's return now to my conversation with musicians Richie Castellano of Blue Oyster Cult and his father, John Castellano.
I had a day job for about a year, you know, a 9 to 6. And I was doing that while I was on tour with Blue Oyster Cult. And I thought to myself, wow, I'm doing absolutely nothing creative right now. I have an office job all day. And then on the weekends, I go out and I play the Blue Oyster Cult set list, which is great, but, you know, I'm replicating. It's not really being creative. So I decided to do what you're doing, and I decided to start a podcast because I listen to podcasts on my way to work, on my commute, and, you know, I thought to myself, oh, I can do this. This doesn't sound that hard, but, you know, as you know, it is hard. There's a lot of work that goes into it. So I originally started it as just a podcast where my friends and I would talk about comic books and movies, but we all happened to be musicians, just musicians who are into, you know, geek stuff. So band geek. And that's what we tried to do. And we got on a comedy network called Riotcast, which at the time was run by a guy named Rob Sprance. And Rob, you know, was very supportive, and he pointed out the obvious. He said, you know, if this is what you want to do, great. You know, I support you. But if you have a bunch of musicians in a room together, people don't want to hear you talk about comic books. They want to hear you play music. So it just seemed so obvious. And I was very against it because I, you know, wanted a break from that. But I said, all right, so we'll do like maybe every few episodes we'll do a song or something. So we did a song, and it, you know, Rob was telling me, oh, that's good. You know, you should film it. Because, you know, you should have some stuff for your YouTube channel. So we said, all right. And early, if you look at the early Band Geek videos, it's just basically after we've had a conversation about, you know, the newest Batman movie, we would pick up the guitars and play a song. And, you know, someone who wasn't holding an instrument would take a phone and with one camera just film us. And I wouldn't really do anything crazy with the mix. I would just do it as quickly as possible because I didn't think anybody was paying attention. Over time, it just became obvious that people were more into the performances than they were into the podcast. So we kind of pivoted to be, you know, almost like a house band that would have guests come and play with us. And we would do a little bit of an interview, but it would really be mostly about the music. And now it's just like, I was just looking at the numbers between the YouTube videos and the podcast interviews, and it's not even close. So now we just basically do the songs. We just do performances.
I'd like to ask you about some of the Band Geeks videos that you've done recently, because you've had to do them during the quarantine or, you know, during the pandemic. So the one that just struck me was, we've been talking about Yes, which is a mutual favorite band, and the song Roundabout, it was so beautifully done. I shared it with kids, high school kids from now, that had never really heard that song. And they watched you perform it and listened to it carefully. They were just like, I had no idea there was music like this. This is just, you know, it was completely alien to them. Could you explain to us how difficult it was? Because you can't just like get on Zoom and have everybody play. How do you go about making something like that?
So I actually have a YouTube video that breaks this down, and because I got an unbelievable amount of emails after that saying, oh, what app are you using? That's my favorite question I get from people. They look at what I do and they go, what app are you using?
They think it's an app.
Which is almost like dismissive of it. It's, you know, anything worth doing takes an enormous amount of work. But the way we did it is, it started here in my studio, and I made the greatest reference track you'd ever want for that, where I tempo mapped the entire song. I figured out where all the, you know, little dips and rises in the tempo were. I programmed them into Pro Tools. Then I did like a little guitar and piano, just like a reference thing, just so everybody can hear where they were, just playing the chords. And then I figured out all of the vocals and I assigned them to people. So I said, okay, Andy, you sing this over here. Anne-Marie, you sing this harmony. I'll sing this harmony. And we did the entire... I basically had to record the song before we recorded the song. And then I gave everybody, you know, a Dropbox link, and I made them their individual reference tracks. I said, okay, here's your vocal part. Please learn this. And they all had the clicks that they needed. And I had like little count offs in the clicks that, you know, basically you wouldn't hear in the finished product, but that's what we needed to stay in time with each other. And everybody, you know, really rose to the occasion there, and they delivered amazing parts to me. And it's easy when you have great musicians. And, you know, and it started with I made Andy do it first. So he recorded his part first, and then I believe me and Anne-Marie recorded our parts at the same time. And because we, you know, it wasn't like we weren't singing to anything. I had the little piano reference just so we can hear what chords we were singing into. So we did it next. Then we sent it to Andy Graziano. He put his guitar and vocal on. And then the last person was Rob Kipp, and he did his keyboards.
Wow. And it's brilliant. And I've shared that with a lot of people. And
thank you.
I don't want to get too far afield on this, but I just, something popped in my head. And if you could give me a real quick take on it, because I want to get into some other really cool stuff before we run out of time. Have you guys noticed this movement on YouTube of these first reaction videos where people are listening to this music that you and I grew up listening to and have loved for years and years, and it's like the first time they've heard it, and so they'll listen to Roundabout for the first time? Or have you noticed that that's a big thing now?
I have. It's just a, I guess now we can capture that pure moment, the first time you are, you know, being exposed to something. I enjoy a lot of them, but, you know, it depends on how charismatic the YouTuber is.
Yeah. Yeah. Some of them are pretty bad, but it is kind of fun to, you know, watch some, you know, it kind of takes you back to the first time you listen to it. Cause I remember the first time I heard Close to the Edge, I hated it.
Yeah.
It was just like, what the hell is this?
That's why I don't really buy a lot of those videos, because some of my favorite music I loathed the first time I ever heard it.
And then after, you know, 20 or 30 listens, you realize this is the greatest thing I've ever heard in my life. Okay, let's talk some more about you dealing with the pandemic. You've got this wonderful live stream show that your dad, you know, takes part in the chat.
He's the star of it.
He's the star of the chat with the dad jokes. How did you get started doing that on Sundays? Tell us about that show.
So I'm a video gamer, but I'm actually not the most hardcore gamer in the room right now. My dad is much more hardcore than I am, but I like playing video games. So are you familiar with Twitch?
Vaguely.
So what Twitch is, it's a streaming site, like a YouTube sort of thing, but it's just people playing video games live, and there's a little, you know, superimposed picture of their head in the corner, and they're reacting, and you're really more so watching the person's personality than the gameplay, you know, but it's like this big cultural phenomenon. But I like Twitch because as an adult with bills and limited time, if I'm going to play a game, if I'm going to buy it and invest time into it, I want to make sure I'm going to enjoy it. So I use Twitch as a way to just, you know, preview a game before I actually purchase it. So I was on Twitch looking for a video game to play, and I saw this guy with a guitar. And this is before Twitch became the huge music platform that it is. And I'm going to give the guy a plug now because he really deserves it. The Twitch channel is called Scene of Action. And there's this guy, Monty, from Portland. And I watched him play, and it was a life-changing event. I was just sitting watching Twitch. And what this guy had done is he had all this automation happening. He had lyrics popping up on the screen. He had lighting changes. He had camera changes. He had guitar effects. He had everything. And being, you know, an engineer, I was able to watch this, and I said, okay, I know how he's doing this. I know how he's doing this. I don't know how he's doing the lights. I don't know how he's doing the cameras. And I was just sitting there just, you know, not only amazed that he was able to put on this caliber of a performance, but just the whole tech side of it and just sitting there thinking about it. And I was thinking either there's an easy way I'm not thinking of, or this is an enormous amount of work I'm looking at. And I threw some money in his tip jar. And I sent him a message on Twitter, and I asked him questions about what he was doing. And he was so gracious. He basically laid it all out for me. And I'm thinking, why would he tell anybody like the secret of what he's doing? Because he's the only guy doing it, you know? And then I realized once I started attempting it for myself, because you have to be crazy to do this amount of work. It's truly an insane undertaking. Not only in just the sheer amount of hours, it's just getting everything to work together. People always ask me, what app do you use for streaming? It's actually about 10 pieces of software and various pieces of hardware all talking to each other. And it breaks down frequently to comical effect on the stream. But, he basically like told me, oh, I'm using this for my lights. I'm using this computer for my cameras. And I basically just watched what he was doing. I watched what a few other streamers were doing and came up with my own version of that. So if you go look at his stream now, it's unbelievable. It looks like a high production value, slick music video. It's really well done. My stream, I tried to make it a little bit more like a live gig. You know, like I'm trying to make it like, you know, he's going for the high production value music video thing. Very polished, very slick, and he's untouchable. I'm trying to go for a little bit more of a hang kind of thing. Almost like you're at the bar. You know what I mean? You're at the club, you're hanging out with everybody. And I'm trying to promote that hang atmosphere. And that's why it really delights me to see people like the chat taking on a life of his own, because that's exactly what I want to do. Is I want this to be a place where we can hang out and kind of pretend that we're all out.
Oh yeah, and it has. It's evolved since I first started experiencing it in the early summer. To, you know, now you've got your group of comedians, a guy named Joey Sawdust, and your dad, and you know the jokes are just hilarious at times and nonstop. So you've got that going on. So you've got the comedy club. You've got you playing, and then you've got all of us just kind of reacting together. And the thing I like about it, you got a really great moderator, John Schultz, that you know keeps everybody in line, keeps everybody. There's no politics allowed, no naughty stuff, no crossing that line. And it's just a very kind, warm place to spend a couple hours and forget about the pandemic and forget about that you can't go out to a club and you can't go watch a live show of Blue Oyster Cult. We have you, and it's been wonderful.
I appreciate that, and it's wonderful for me too to be able to play. The result of all this is that I'm actually my voice from doing this show every week. I've never done it this long. When I would do it, I would do it for a few months and it wouldn't be every week because I would have Blue Oyster Cult gigs, but I've never done it like this so many consecutive weeks. My voice is actually stronger than it's ever been just from doing these shows. So there's a benefit to me too, to do it other than the obvious.
It's funny when I watch it, I see people from Austria, from France, from Italy, and they're whatever time it is in their in a part of the world, they tune into this show to be part of this, conglomerate of friends, and it's wonderful. And the thing with the, you know, how you infuse the lighter side of jokes being stuck in this format, it sort of reminds me, there was an old show, I mean, this is going to be hard for you, I don't think you're in my age bracket whatsoever, but in my day, there was a show called Andy's Gang, and it was on Sundays. And what it was a guy, he'd show a movie and he'd talk a little to the kids and he'd go, "Hi kids, it's Andy's Gang." And there would be a little frog and his name was Froggy. And he'd always come out and say something devilish in between something. And he'd throw, whoever was saying something, he'd throw them off kilter. And I thought back, this is sort of like that. It's like, you know, he's doing a show, it's about music. And while he's going over to change a mic or push a setting, and there's all this dialogue running up and down the thing. I said, this reminds me of Andy's Gang with Andy Devine.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I know who he is. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. But now on to the big thing that you've been involved with. We've mentioned Blue Oyster Cult several times. You've been playing with them for years now. And we don't really have time to go into your origins with those, but I would like to know about this new album you guys have put out, The Symbol Remains, because it's getting very good reviews. I've listened to it many times, and I think it's outstanding.
Thank you.
And you play a very big part, and your dad's in it too. John, you're in it also. It's a fantastic album. Tell us a bit about your role in producing and performing and writing some of the music on The Symbol Remains.
So when I joined the band in 2004, I was told that we were going to be releasing lots of new music. So it never panned out that way. It just there's a lot of logistics involved in recording an album with a band that doesn't live near each other. You know, hotels and flights need to be booked, things like that. Studio time, it's difficult. So every few years, you know, for the last 16 years, there'd be an offer. And I'd hear a rumor throughout the organization that we might have a record deal. And my father always taught me the value of being prepared. So when I heard the rumor, I would start writing songs. And I would just write until no, no, it's not happening. Okay, then I would stop writing. And this happened 3 or 4 times over the last 16 years. And every time that would happen, I would just write music. And I would throw it in a folder on my computer. And that's that. Then I actually said, okay, to hell with this. This is never happening. I'm going to just make my own album, because I hadn't really been releasing original music. And the Stream Gang got me to, you know, back in the mood to write. So I started working on my own album. And just as I'm in the thick of it, like there's hundreds of things happening at once. I'm dealing with all these different musicians. I'm recording it. I have so many hours logged into it. Blue Oyster Cult actually gets the record deal. They actually signed the deal. So now I put that aside and I said, okay. And I started writing again. And I basically put all the songs I had written in a Dropbox folder and sent it to the guys. I said, look, here's everything I got. Anything you like, I'd be thrilled if you would consider one of my songs. One of my songs. That's what I was really hoping for. And Buck and Eric, they said, yeah, we'll use one of these. Yeah. And as the process got, you know, as we got further and further along and we got closer to the time where we had to start recording, they would frequently say, hey, let's try this other song you have in your folder. Or how about this other song? Or Eric would come over and he would say, hey, I got this idea for a song. And he would have like a riff or something and he and I would finish it together. So we were basically just grabbing songs from my Dropbox folder. Eric would come up with fragments and we would polish them, you know, and finish them and build them up together. And then, of course, Buck had a bunch of songs. And Jules, our drummer, he had a song. So everybody's kind of throwing into the pot. And then by the time we had the list finalized, I looked at the list. I said, oh my God, like I'm not writing one song on this album. I'm writing or co-writing 6 songs on this album.
Finally, Dad, you know, what was it like for you, you know, laying down some tracks with Richie and Blue Oyster Cult on this album?
Oh, it's just like, come over here. I want you to do something.
Thanks so much to our guests, Richie and John Castellano. Check out Richie's website at richiecastellano.com. And if you love classic rock music, I highly recommend you check out his live streaming performances on YouTube every Sunday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. I guarantee you won't be disappointed. And pro tip, be sure and check out the comedians telling jokes in the live chat. During this time of pandemic, when you can't go to a live show, this has been a wonderful way to spend a couple of hours every weekend. And for the record, my favorite song he plays is Astronomy, duh. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX, and if you missed an episode or want to share one, check out our archives at mynspr.org. Subscribe to our podcast via the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of A Dog Named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.